This is Brian Forrester, and welcome back to the Active Investor Podcast, part of Lord Abbett's Investment Conversation Series. In these podcasts, we talk to experts and investors about equities, everything from long-term trends, risk factors, how changing market dynamics influence stock prices, how clients may want to think about incorporating different areas of the equity markets, and really just where some of the big mega trends are building. And in this episode, we are getting two topics on the table that you might not think go together at first blush, inflation and innovation. Jeff Herzog and I have been discussing these topics together in a presentation that you can find on the insights section of lordabbett.com. And we found that these two topics are really at the heart of what's happening in the economy today. You've got this new phenomenon of, let's call it post-COVID inflation. And we've had something of a boom and bust in innovation stocks, even though the technological revolution continues to gain steam and innovation continues to change the way we do things and really change the world in pretty dramatic ways. But in the past year, inflation has had a direct impact on the negative performance of many stocks, especially those that did really well in 2020 as we needed innovation. Those same companies and the stocks of those companies have sold off pretty dramatically. So first, let me just first welcome Jeff Herzog here to the podcast.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So a quick background on Jeff. He's worked at Lord Abbott since 2013, and he wears two hats here, both as a portfolio manager on our multi-asset strategies and as an economist. And he's been in the financial services industry since 2009. He has a PhD in management studies and a master's in economics, both from Cambridge University, as well as a bachelor's in history from Yale. So quite a wide-ranging perspective there. And I think as you hear him talk today, you'll get the sense that he has a very interesting perspective on the markets and their interaction with the economy. So, Jeff, I just gave kind of the broad strokes of your background. Maybe you can give a little bit more color as to how you've ended up in this kind of wide-ranging role here at Lord Abbett.
Yeah, I had a pretty unique experience getting into the financial services industry because when I formally finished my PhD, it was September of 2008, which was a terrible time to be, you know, graduating and getting into the working world.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I found a job as a, you know, traditional sell side economist with BBVA, but it was in Texas, which is also another unusual destination. So I kind of started life as a Texas banker, though as an economist, I wasn't really doing any actual banking. But the BBVA at the time had owned a bank that had predominantly operated in the South as a commercial bank. And most of the bank's concentration was there. And they needed economists there like they do in, you know, Mexico or Chile or Spain. And it was a really unique experience because I don't know how many banks employ that many economists. For example, they probably had 130, 150 economists at the time. And that's almost like, you know, the number of economists that a international organization might have to study things. So I got a really good experience to different parts of how, you know, economists work in the financial system and evaluate it. And it was a great start to my career. And overall, you know, I got more interested in investing itself. And that's how I eventually gravitated towards a role at Lord Abbett here in New York City.
Well, an interesting road up until now. And I think we are clearly living through some interesting times today. So again, we're going to focus on inflation and its impact today. And some of that will be its implications for equity investors. And again, in the presentation that accompanies this podcast, in the front section, Jeff highlights some of the key metrics he and his team look at around the different gauges of inflation across the economy, drivers of wage inflation, labor market dynamics. And then as you go through those slides, we then shift to looking at some of the powerful secular themes in the economy that center on technological innovation. We talk a little bit about what Ben Abel and I talked about in the prior podcast, the great advantage in recent decades to those companies that can self-fund their growth through R&D investment. And then lastly, the historical record of growth and value stocks in a rising interest rate environment. So Jeff, the first question I think we have to ask is about, you know, what's going on right now with inflation as you see it. You know, it's been hot. Are you seeing any early evidence of any change to that dynamic? Is there any good news yet? What are you seeing out there?
The short answer is that this most recent CPI report was a continuation of the trend where we see very broad-based inflation. So I don't think it really gives us an all-clear signal yet. But at the same time, we should see something of a difference open up between CPI inflation and another measurement of inflation called personal consumption expenditures inflation, which is what the Fed tends to focus on. And the reason for that is mostly a difference in weighting from housing and also difference in treatment of medical care. I think that'll become more of a theme because one measure will look less scary than the other. But overall, I'd say, you know, we still have very broad-based inflation. And so the Fed won't look at this one month and think that things are improving just yet. And, you know, it's funny when you mentioned post-COVID inflation. I was thinking the economy kind of has long COVID when you said that. Like, this is the symptom of, you know, COVID really is the hugely imbalanced demand. You know, services are just coming back. And when you go back and look at the results, specifically, people were more focused on the month-on-month changes because, you know, they're trying to see what the current running pace is of inflation because the year-ago comparison is getting more favorable going forward. And so when you dip into that for the consumer price index, you can see that services inflation, just core services inflation, was running at a very high annualized month-on-month rate. Core itself, month-on-month surprise to the upside. There was also a methodology change in new car prices. And this is a little bit inside baseball, you know, for the people who really dig down into the individual components. But some months it can be very meaningful. And lastly, something we're always looking at is owner's equivalent rent, because that's a, you know, large chunk of the index itself. It's very salient to people. They notice it. And, you know, that rent and housing inflation is still very steady. But taking a step back from the actual release, we tend to really look at the data that comes out a few hours later from the Cleveland Fed. And what they do is distill the CPI data into measures that are supposed to capture the trend in inflation more with more affinity. And that's called the Cleveland Fed median and trim mean inflation indices. And basically, they cut away some of the more volatile extremes of the many detailed subcategories. And so when that data came out, it basically confirmed to me, at least, that inflation was still very broad and still trending at a very high level. And so, you know, I don't think that this is a sea change yet. And I think that partially explains, you know, how the market has reacted to the data in the following week or two.
Okay. So not exactly cooling off a whole lot yet. So the big concern then in the markets, now that we've kind of done away with the word transitory, and then inflation is clearly here for a while and needs to be addressed, is will the Fed drive the economy into a recession? And, you know, we'll get to markets in a bit, but it's starting to look like the equity market thinks there's a recession coming.
I think it makes sense to be worried about a recession when the Fed tightens. And we've seen a notable drawdown in equity markets now twice in recent memory, you know, in 2018 and now the current year. And so while I don't believe that'll be a pattern that you could rely on all the time, I think, you know, recent experience suggests that, you know, cutting risk when the Fed is minded to tighten is notable. I do think that this is not a time to be maximally positioned with risk, but at the same time, I'm not completely certain that we are, you know, inevitably on the road to recession. There are mixed signals in the market. You know, I think this is the kind of environment where you do end up falling into recession. And I think the probability is there. And I think the market is justified in pricing it in. So, you know, going from strong economic growth to where leading indicators are taking you lower, that's how you get from the high growth regime to the recessionary regime. And another kind of historical analogy is back to the 70s, where you had an inflation problem, and then you had either a policy mistake or another supply shock that kind of heaped stress on the system. And we're kind of seeing that now. Like, we had high inflation, and then we had some supply chain problems, and then we had a war. And all this has been a kind of stress stacking pattern that make, you know, inflation very strong and persistent. And on the flip side of that, I think we have a very favorable starting point. I think we have robust balance sheets for consumers and businesses. I think we have very strong labor market growth, strong wage growth. And so that will provide some cushion. But undeniably, I think, you know, we're having some concerning signs for global growth. You know, China has really taken a leg down in growth and won't, you know, immediately jump back to growth expectations we had, you know, a few months ago. And when it comes to specifically to the Fed, I don't think there is a one-size-fits-all hiking cycle. I think there can be different narratives that you can apply to historical Fed tightening regimes. A safe landing is possible. It is tricky to pull off. I think to be able to differentiate them, you have to look back at what the Fed is trying to do and what problems it's facing. So undeniably, 1972, 1977, 1980, the Fed wasn't trying to make it soft. They were just trying to crush inflation. And they were tightening very rapidly and very strongly in order to create that. From 2015 to 2019, I think you can argue that the Fed actually did achieve soft landing. You know, if it wasn't for the coronavirus, like, I don't think we would have tipped into recession or even seen a recession. So that is a pattern that you see too. You know, going back to the regime analogy, you know, you have strong growth and slowing leading indicators, but if the Fed backs off, you see a resumption of growth. And I think, you know, 2018, 19 kind of fit that pattern. And 1994 is considered the perfect soft landing, which may not be a great analogy now because the market is definitely not believing we'll have a perfect soft landing. And also the bond market did suffer, you know, 1993, 1994, as they, you know, incorporated the Fed's tightening guidance and actions. But what happened was the Fed got to a level, decided that the economy was slowing, and a combination of very strong job growth, very good productivity really kept a lid on any inflation problems, growth problems at that time. So that was an example of something where we can get through a Fed tightening cycle alive. But I think at this point, the question is, has the market priced it enough relative to the damage we expect? I think to a large part, yes, with caveats, because I think what the market wants to see now is more confirmation that fundamentals are deteriorating. And that could be, you know, a drop in new home sales. It could be further deterioration in PMIs. So I think the valuation and the expectations are more aligned now going forward.
So Jeff, you've been very rightly saying over the past year that value looks a lot more attractive than growth. And we've certainly seen some massive drawdowns in many high growth stocks. Many of the names that kind of led the market during the lockdowns in 2020, when we so badly needed innovation, have gone down, you know, 60, 70, 80% from their peaks, especially the unprofitable ones. And then very recently, we've seen some big retailers that you'd probably find more in the value indexes getting pummeled for clear signs in their earnings that inflation is starting to eat away at their margins. So are you still in the value camp after all that's happened?
So we have tended to favor value over the past year, but we are paring back that exposure slightly, recognizing some of the slowdown risks we have, because our current value exposure is mostly in deep value, and that will not be favorable given it. They tend to be levered or cyclical exposures. And so right now, I'd say we're just slightly tilted towards value, maybe in the realm of 57-43 value growth mix. And let's say you're just having a shallow exposure, that could a shallow economic slowdown, that could be really favorable for growth stocks exposure, because they will be the type of firms that still have, you know, growth in that environment. Though I do wonder sometimes about the new higher rate environment we'll be in, because it's not as if the Fed is going to be rapidly back to zero when we're sort of awakened to a new inflationary trend, a global kind of inflation level that is happening in a lot of places. So I was kind of wondering, Brian, what you think about companies innovating in an environment of, you know, higher inflation, higher rates, because people were innovating in the 70s when, you know, rates were 10% or inflation was X percent. People were still inventing stuff and innovating. So how do we think about those exposures going forward?
Yeah, a couple things there. So number one, you know, back to the comment you made earlier, just in a lower GDP growth world, growth has, you know, if you go back over the past 60 years, growth has outperformed value pretty dramatically. It's kind of like getting there, you know, figuring out when do we get to that point. And the Fed, we're assuming that the Fed is likely going to get the job done in some form. But to your point also, it does seem like we're getting back to more normal levels relative to history, normal levels of inflation. It's kind of like the past 13 years have been the abnormality, having such low interest rate environments, such low inflation. So to your question, you know, I think the bar is higher. Yeah. You know, as you said, there has been great innovation in various points in history in very different market environments. And I think from an investment standpoint, it's been to your peril to be on the wrong side of that, to be kind of owning the companies that are getting disrupted.
Yeah.
And over long periods of time, you know, you could go back to the Industrial Revolution. You could go back to, you know, electrification at the end of the 1800s, automobiles, airplanes, you know, Bell Labs in the 1930s, all these great innovations throughout the last 100 years. Being a long-term investor has paid off dramatically, but you also have memories of 99. And certainly I don't think this is the same thing as 1999, but some of the market action lately gives me a little bit of a chill, 'cause I remember that period. But to your question, the bar is higher. So the types of companies that we think will do well, we will be those that are able to kind of self-fund their own R&D, that don't have to lean on financing costs or debt to fund those types of projects. Those have been the kind of companies and business models that have proven over longer periods of time to be able to weather these types of environments and be true secular growers. And I think the last thing I would say is, you know, the last 40 years, we've seen the rapid ascent of the asset-light business model. And a lot of the companies that even right now during earnings season that are showing better results and not seeing a lot of the pressure from inflation are those where most of their assets are more intangible assets. They're not facing the same types of input cost pressure, labor cost pressure that a lot of, say, older economy companies are facing right now. That might be a bit of a broad generalization, but to your question about, you know, how can innovation still thrive in a higher interest rate environment, I think those are some of the things that we're thinking about. So I alluded to higher labor costs. Jeff, it's a tight market, at least in terms of workers having a lot of leverage and bargaining power, maybe even a potential revival in organized labor. But that being said, a big concern in the labor market is still the low-end consumer in an inflationary environment and the real income squeeze there. So how are you thinking about that issue?
I think that's a very topical question, because we've seen recent company earnings throw a lot of focus on that. And from a broader perspective, to me, we've been wrestling with this issue for a few months now. Real personal disposable income for households has been on the decline for something like 5 months. So this is something that's been weighing on the consumer for some time. I also think that the currently depressed state of surveys for consumers, a lot of that, I think, is about inflation, really. I think if you go back in time and look at combinations of when the consumer was this downbeat, but at the same time, the credit card or consumer default rate that you get from the Federal Reserve is this low, you know, you'll find like 1973, 1974, you know, kind of come up from your screen. And I think that speaks to, you know, the job market is really supporting a lot of people. It's not what I would call people depressed about their employment, you know, prospects. I think what they've been a little bummed out about is their purchasing power, which has been eroded by this burst of inflation. And so undoubtedly, people have pointed out, you know, the low level of confidence. They've pointed to some issues in recent company earnings. But we look at, you know, different sources of data on the consumer. You know, in addition to monitoring, you know, delinquency rates, we also look at things like weekly data from the Census Bureau, which outlines business formations, for example, and those are still running at pretty high levels. And that's a rough leading indicator of employment. It tells me that employment's still holding together. We also look at the Census Weekly Pulse, which is kind of a newish survey that they've put together over time. And that's got a more mixed, I think, reading on the consumer. One thing I tried to zero in very quickly on that was how consumers were experiencing this energy price shock. And surprisingly, that doesn't show much increase in distress in the specific energy category. There has been an increase in people having some difficulty in making payments in general. That's like a separate question in that. But to me, it doesn't seem like that figure is off the charts. It's really just back to, say, early 2021 or late 2020 readings. And so if the job market keeps holding together, creating employment, we keep seeing these robust wage gains, I think we can kind of cushion ourselves to a point where the difference in experience inflation and earned nominal income is less extreme. And I think we have a great summary of all those labor market indicators in the deck. For instance, there's this one slide basically shows you, you know, where we were before COVID, what the historical average is, and it's kind of like a little labor market dashboard.
So you're seeing some early headlines of companies either laying people off or slowing their hiring. Do you think that's the beginning of a trend that we should start to extrapolate, or how are you guys? And it's sort of a related question, but I think it's something that you're starting to see and the market's reacting to it. So
for an economist, I think where we pick up that same theme is in the initial jobless claim. So, you know, people get fired, they go get unemployment insurance. And the 4-week moving average of that has ticked up a little bit. I mean, it's nothing that I really consider alarming at this point, because what you'd be really worried about was a really sharp increase. That is definitely a sign of a problem. It's actually one of our more, you know, timely coincident indicators of the labor market. So I think there is some churn happening. But with the current high level of job openings, some of these jobs are going to get filled by these people getting fired. I think it's a question of whether their skills are transferable, and hopefully mostly they are, and they'll be able to jump in what is a very favorable labor market for workers right now. And I think they should survive.
Okay. Last question. So how do you see innovation and labor interacting, let's say, over the next 10 to 20 years? Because, you know, we've had political candidates run on one issue of just kind of giving people money, you know, UBI, on the premise that so many jobs are going to just be wiped out and there just won't be jobs for people anymore because of innovation. How are you guys thinking about that issue?
Yeah, there certainly were a lot of UBI experiments at the city level in the aftermath of COVID. I think it's a really interesting sort of chemistry lab of economic policy. I think what that relates to is something I was reading the other day in a great book by Robert Shiller. It's called Narrative Economics, and he goes through basically like perennial narratives over time. One of them is this issue of job killing automation. And I was really surprised to see how often it comes back in history. And it's not just a recent phenomenon. It goes back like decades and decades. One notable episode was in like the late 50s. And then, you know, the concern was about, you know, computers and automation of certain jobs. There was even like this movie with Spencer Tracy where he had, you know, his enemy was basically a computer mainframe in it. And so people have been concerned before about automation, and the equivalent today is AI, because we've seen AI replace jobs that are routine and can be codified into specific rules. And so examples of that are like radiologists. So you get enough images of a lung and a computer can spot the problem, and accountants, because, you know, tax laws can be really distilled down to, you know, a set of rules and equations. And what I think is really interesting is that, you know, not all technologies wipe away jobs. You know, when they invented jet travel, you know, it created huge productivity for pilots and expanded job opportunities for pilots, and that, you know, it created a much larger industry. And so undoubtedly, while there are some technologies that replace what humans do, there's a much larger opportunity set at work here. So if you can think of all the stuff that humans do, put that in one bucket. And a small part of that is what humans can do better than machines. But there's a much larger realm of things that humans and machines can do together. So if you can think of something like collaborative robots, which has really blossomed because now we're much better at computer vision and simulation of, you know, spaces and working areas, and much greater precision on the side of the robotic implements. You know, I think that there is a much more vast scope for machines working with humans to expand into new opportunities for everybody. So I don't think it's just the case that technology always destroys jobs. I think part of the answer might be in technology policy in some way, and smarter people can figure out how to exactly optimize, you know, tax policy to make sure we get that result. But I think that's how we can maybe save ourselves from having to do UBI, is to say, you know, hey, we can push technology innovation, be more incentivized towards expanding the opportunity set instead of just shrinking it.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. Great stuff. This has been a valuable look at the impacts of inflation today, as well as some food for thought on investing in equities in what may be a very different regime ahead. Again, for listeners wanting to learn more about Lord Abbett's views on inflation and equity investing, we'd encourage you to visit the insight section of the lordabbott.com website. And you can also find the presentation that we've been referencing, which is titled Innovation Investing, Aiming to Build a More Resilient Portfolio During Uncertain Times. You can also reach out to your Lord Abbott representative to request a copy of the presentation. And so we'll leave it there. This has been the Active Investor Podcast, and thank you for listening.
Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite streaming app of choice. The U.S. Federal Reserve, or Fed, is the central bank of the United States. The federal funds, or Fed funds, rate is the target interest rate set by the Fed, at which commercial banks borrow and lend their excess reserves to each other overnight. Gross domestic product, or GDP, is the monetary value of all finished goods and services produced within a country's borders in a specific time period, though GDP is usually calculated on an annual basis. It includes all private and public consumption, government outlays, investments, and exports, less imports, that occur within a defined territory. Growth/value investing. Growth stocks may be characterized as equities of companies that have demonstrated better than average gains in earnings in recent years and that are expected to continue delivering high levels of profit growth. Growth equities typically carry higher price-to-earning multiples than the broader market, higher earning growth records, and greater volatility than the broader market. Secular growth stocks are stocks of companies whose economic performance is relatively immune to economic cycles. Value stocks may be characterized as equities of companies that have fallen out of favor with investors but still have good fundamentals, or new companies that have yet to be recognized by investors. Value stocks typically feature lower price-to-earning multiples than the broader market and often industry peers, and somewhat lower volatility than the overall equity market. Mentions of specific companies are for reference purposes only and are not meant to describe the investment merits of, or potential, or actual portfolio changes related to, securities of those companies. Unless otherwise noted, all discussions are based on U.S. markets and U.S. monetary and fiscal policies. The credit quality of the securities in a portfolio is assigned by a nationally recognized statistical rating organization, or NSRO, such as Standard & Poor's, Moody's, or Fitch, as an indication of an issuer's creditworthiness. Ratings range from AAA, which is the highest, to D, which is the lowest. Bonds rated BBB or above are considered investment grade. Credit ratings BB and below are lower rated securities, or junk bonds. High-yielding, non-investment grade bonds, or junk bonds, involve higher risks than investment grade bonds. Adverse conditions may affect the issuer's ability to pay interest and principal on these securities. Investing involves risk, including the loss of principal. The value of investments in fixed income securities will change as interest rates fluctuate and in response to market movements. Generally, when interest rates rise, the price of debt securities fall, and when interest rates fall, prices generally rise. The municipal market can be affected by adverse tax, legislative, or political changes, and by the financial condition of the issuers of municipal securities. Investments in non-U.S. or emerging market securities, which may be adversely affected by economic, political, or regulatory factors and subject to currency volatility and greater liquidity risk. The value of investments in equity securities will fluctuate in response to general economic conditions and changes in prospects of particular companies and/or sectors in the economy. No investing strategy can overcome all market volatility or guarantee future results. Market forecasts and projections are based on current market conditions and subject to change without notice. Projections should not be considered a guarantee. The views and opinions expressed by the Lord Abbott speaker are those of the speaker as of the date of the broadcast and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm as a whole. Any such views are subject to change at any time based upon market conditions or other conditions, and Lord Abbott disclaims any responsibility to update such views. This material is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, or investment advice. It is not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any securities or to adopt any investment strategy. Neither Lord Abbott nor the Lord Abbott speaker can be responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the information offered. The information provided is not directed at any investor or category of investors and is provided solely as general information about Lord Abbott's products and services and to otherwise provide general investment education. None of the information provided should be regarded as a suggestion to engage in or refrain from any investment-related course of action, as neither Lord Abbott nor its affiliates are undertaking to provide impartial investment advice, act as an impartial advisor, or give advice in a fiduciary capacity. If you are an individual retirement investor, contact your financial advisor or other fiduciary about whether any given instrument, idea, strategy, product, or service may be appropriate for your circumstances. This broadcast is copyright 2021 of Lord Abbott & Co., LLC. All rights reserved. This recording may not be reproduced in whole or in part or in any form without the permission of Lord Abbott. Lord Abbott Mutual Funds are distributed by Lord Abbott Distributor, LLC. This broadcast is copyright 2022 of Lord Abbott & Co., LLC. All rights reserved. This recording may not be reproduced in whole or in part or in any form without the permission of Lord Abbott. Lord Abbott Mutual Funds are distributed by Lord Abbott Distributor, LLC.